Go
This
away.
conference will now be recorded.
All right. Good evening, everyone.
Evening.
Evening.
Tonight, I should say welcome to another session of Shared Experiences, where we bring people in to have them share their knowledge and experience to help us all learn. Tonight, we have our guest speaker is Dr. Keith Wright. And the topic tonight is going to be managing your business opportunities, during COVID-19, which, most of our guests, always being entrepreneurs, think this is an appropriate topic. What I'm going to do is, always start off and I let my guests kind of just tell a little bit about themselves before we actually get into discussion. So, and I got to put the disclaimer out there, all right? Full disclosure, I should say, is that the guest speaker tonight happens to be my older brother, all right? Keith, he may slip up and call me by my nickname, but it doesn't matter. And if he does, I'm going to in turn call him by his nickname.
Uh-oh.
Or at least what I used to call him when I was a kid. To Keith, or as I like to call him, to Brother Keith, would you, give us a few minutes and just tell us about your background.
Sure. When I think about that question now, I sort of wonder how far do I have to go back? But I would say for your audience, I am a product of the inner city, Orange, New Jersey, that has been blessed to branch out, across America and the world, both in terms of work and education. I started work. I like to tell this story. I never want to leave this out. I started work at the tender age of 8 years old with my Uncle Ollie. And the best way to describe that experience was we were the original Sanford and Son, meaning that we used to go and pick up scrap metals and tires and batteries and take them to different places that would then give us cash or currency. Until Uncle Ali built a huge tire business where he actually had probably 3 acres of space in downtown Newark on Doremus Avenue.
Wow.
I share that experience because working with him every summer did a couple of things for me. One, it introduced me to having cash in my pocket, which I learned to enjoy. It introduced me to discipline and work. And so I have part of my own work ethic through the years is that hard work does pay off. And so as I matured and left high school, I went to college. In college, I originally thought I was going to be interested in electrical engineering, but that quickly turned to an interest in history. And having an interest in history at the time, I was told, well, you only thing you could do with that is teach. And so I said, okay, that's not a problem. But at the time, teachers were making less than minimum wage. And so I turned my focus to technology with the thought in my head that if I work with technology, since technology was always changing, I would always be employable. And so I went to school for history, which I loved and continue. I still love today. But I worked and grew my career in technology for the first 20 years of my career. And then I switched from technology to community services. And so my background is corporate America, 40 plus years. Having worked at a number of major companies. But what ties all of my activity together has always been my desire to teach and to share and to educate. And so I had to use my history background and my technology background to move in a space where I could then become supervisor, manager, vice president, executive vice president, so on. But always using those platforms to mentor, to educate, and to teach. And so interesting thing that Eureka, my wife, likes to talk about is when we go different places and she sees people from my background, whether it's Fannie Mae or Citibank or Congressional Black Caucus background, one of the things almost to a person, they always say to her, your husband taught me this, or your husband was a good mentor, or your husband was that. And so I pride myself on that because that's important to me to be able to educate and to teach and to bring others along, which brings me to the current space that I'm in right now working for the Port Authority. And this is actually my second tour working for the Port Authority.
All right. Before going forward, I just want to, you know, touch on a couple of things that Keith just mentioned, which was, again, our Uncle Ollie, because just like Keith, I had the opportunity to work for my Uncle Ollie when he had that tire shop down in Newark. And again, that going, getting up early in the morning, he'd come pick me up early in the morning and working with him and getting, I don't know what you got paid, Keith, but by the time I came through, I got a whopping $5 a day or probably an 8 to 10 hour day. Some days you came back and you didn't get your money. You had, you know, you said, oh, you know, you can, you know, I'll pay you on Friday or whatever it was.
My salary was $1.25 a day. And I asked him to hold the dollar until Friday and give me the quarter each night so I can buy popsicles for my siblings.
Wow.
Yep.
I'm impressed. I think you got paid more than me once I do the calculations. $1.25 a day.
$1.25 a day. That's what I started out.
But he's also, Keith, I don't know if you saw any of the emails, but I launched something called Your Shoulders, which is a tribute to our community entrepreneurs.
Oh, okay.
And on the landing page, there's a dedication to Uncle Ollie and Harry Hunt for exposing me as a kid to Black entrepreneurship.
Beautiful.
So, you know, and again, the thing he mentions that you probably picked up, Shelley, is, yes, we have this passion for teaching, educating, as in this platform itself is about teaching and educating other people.
And so you know, when I think about that, just quickly, Uncle Ollie didn't have much of a formal education. And when he took me on at 8 years old, he was 40 years old. And when I kind of roll the clock back, I think about how many 40 years old want to ride around trying to run their business with an 8 year old in their truck all day long. But he did it. He did it. So definitely stand on his shoulders. Exactly. Yes.
And now you factor in the time when I came along, mm-hmm. I was about 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we sit and do the math, you figure he was a few years older
exactly.
at that time. His mm-hmm. business was much larger. And I don't ever remember him having a actual staff of people.
Right.
You know, it was probably all nephews or, you know, relatives that he picked up here and there. But he built something. And that's the whole thing with your shoulders are all of these community entrepreneurs who actually sustained communities and families.
Exactly.
Through exactly. their, you know, business ownership. And we just saw them as, oh, so-and-so owns a business, the corner store. You know? Mm-hmm. But they, I think the whole purpose of that, and not to get sidetracked, is acknowledging them, because before the Tyler Perrys and the Oprahs, mm-hmm. there were all of these business owners in the community that got us through.
Exactly.
So bringing it current, Keith, you know, mentioned in your current position, because we're going to tie your current position to, you know, just some of the discussion tonight.
Sure.
Just tell us about your role right now, you know, dealing with minority businesses.
Okay. And so you may have heard there's a lot of talk around the country about diversity and inclusion. And inside corporate America for the last several years, we've had what we call D&I departments to focus on diversity and inclusion, both on the businesses that the corporation deals with or the agency entity deals with, as well as on the workforce side. And so I rejoined the Port Authority in the diversity and inclusion department And my task was simply, we need you to work on building capacities of the, we call them M&W, MWBE community. And the reason for that was there is a, and I just had this conversation today, there has been this ongoing collision course where there are a number of successful, qualified, enterprising, minority and women-owned businesses, Black and brown businesses that are in our communities, in the larger communities. But for some reason, folks inside the organization or those who have larger firms, when the companies ask them, we want you to utilize the minority and women-owned businesses to help them build, there's a constant refrain, we can't find them. And so my job was created specifically not only to demonstrate that you don't have to go looking for them, they're right here, but also where there were opportunities to build the firm's capacity through education, through training, through mentoring, through pre-apprentice programs or what have you. That was my assignment to do that. So I focus on, and I should say right now that my primary focus is on architects and engineers. Because in the business that we do, there's a healthy representation of construction programs, construction mentoring programs. But for some reason, there was not equal focus on professional services. So architects and engineers, the companies then look at them as how do we provide entryway or a platform to help them also work on their business. So that's my focus in that space right now. And so one of the things we did initially coming in was to create what we call a Principals Academy. And I identified a number of architectural and engineering firms, majority African-American and Hispanic. And I pulled them together. I identified a training partner out of Arkansas that had spent 30 years in the, we call A&E industry. And we put together a boot camp. We invited, I think we had 18 firms in our first boot camp. And we brought them together for a 3-day period where we, the whole idea was, one, you have your license, you're professionals, you're good at what you do, but you are limited because of you don't have the staff that the big firms have. And so you are the rainmaker, you process the invoices, you do the meetings, you do the scheduling, you do everything and maybe have one or two assistants. And it's really hard to multiply or grow your business. What we wanted them to do was to break away for a period of time and then give them dedicated help on how to work on your business as opposed to working in your business. And so we brought the best of marketing tools and tips to them. We brought the best of HR tools that they needed to have. You know, we talked to them about succession planning. We talked to them about how do you write an effective RFP? How do you do a bid response? All the things that could really help them work on their business. And the other thing that we shared with them at the time was, while we're bringing you together under our roof, we also want you to begin to coalesce and work with each other, because as we and other agencies and companies let out requests for proposals, your firm might not be strong enough standing alone. But if you would joint venture or team with any one of the folks that's part of this cohort, that's you gain strength in numbers. And what really pleases me about talking about that initial outset that we started in, kickoff was December of 2018. We now have two cohorts, about 34 firms altogether, and they're spread across the country, but most of them are located in this particular region, New York.
Nice.
They have created, between the two, a third entity called the Coalition of Black Architects and Engineers. And now they joint venture for opportunities, not just with our agency, but with agencies around the region. So that's very satisfying to see that an idea that you started with the purpose of helping build capacity, they're now taking it to the next level, and they're teaming and joint venturing and growing their business. That's very satisfying, very rewarding.
That's actually, you know, great to hear, because one of the things that we push in our space is, again, the collaboration.
Yes.
You know, and how important that is, and not from just accessing bigger projects, but it also exposes you to different customers, because by partnering with someone, they're going to carry you into their customer segment and vice versa.
So exactly.
It's really shifting that mindset from, as entrepreneurs, of that competitiveness, you know, because you could be in the same space and collaborate, you know, and a lot of times not taught that way, because you talk, we're in the same space, we're supposed to compete.
Right.
Well, you actually can get much further ahead in certain times to collaborate. So that's actually, it's pretty good to hear that. And especially the growth.
Right.
And especially for, again, people of color in the architect and engineering spaces. I would like to see that replicated in other areas, you know, even like in the sciences, you know. So that's actually really great to hear. Given your role and experience, could you share some of your advice, you know, to say small business owners about doing business with a government or quasi-government entity?
Now, sure. So we are public servants, our agency, and we, the Port Authority, is a bi-state agency for New York and New Jersey, formed in 1921 by an act of Congress. And to your point of collaboration and cooperation, just, you know, for your listeners, you know, if you could just think about a major ship coming up the Hudson River with tons and tons of product, and customers on the New Jersey side and customers on the New York side, entrepreneurs on the New York side, entrepreneurs on the New Jersey side, there was a lot of back and forth in terms of how do you manage where to take this ship? In other words, where is it going to dock? Is it going to dock on the New York side because they're going to give them, you know, a certain price point, or is it going to dock on the New Jersey side because they'll give them a better price point? And so the wisdom of creating a bi-state agency in 1921 was very ahead of its time, because then the agency itself would manage, you know, the movement and of the transportation coming, goods and services coming into the region. And so for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with the Port Authority, what we are responsible for is the transportation infrastructure in the region, the bridges that go from New Jersey to New York, whether it's the Gothos, the George Washington Bridge, the tunnels, Lincoln Tunnel, Holland Tunnel, the airports, Newark Airport, Kennedy Airport, LaGuardia Airport, Stewart Airport, upstate New York, and even we had agreement with Trenton Airport here in South Jersey. And so we're responsible for those transportations. And some people are familiar with the gigantic bus terminal that's at 42nd Street. And most people would think that's the whole Port Authority, but that's the Port Authority bus terminal, as there is a bus terminal at George Washington Bridge as well. And so when you think about, you know, over 200 pre-COVID, you know, 170 million people flying in and out of the region every year. And Newark Airport alone taking on about 60 million of those, you can see sort of the huge reach of the Port Authority. So I set that background to get to your question. There's a great deal of opportunity for minority and women-owned businesses to do work with the Port Authority, as well as with the MTA, New York City, New Jersey Transportation, New Jersey Transit, so on and so forth. And what all of us have in common is we have a certification process that would identify the entrepreneurs as being certified by our agency or one of the other agencies. Why is that important? That's important because in order to have diversity and inclusion, in order to create equity, we want to make sure that the money we're spending, that we can spend it in such a way that the larger firms who have been in this space for a long time can work collaboratively with the smaller firms to help bring them up to a certain level of capacity. And the way we encourage that is to stipulate, our Board of Commissioners stipulate, that every contract that we let out, whoever wins that contract has to demonstrate 30% minority woman participation. And so what that means is, in order for them to bring contractors onto the job that they just won a big contract for, they look to our list of certified vendors. And so the first thing we encourage folks, regardless of what your business is, we encourage folks at least register with the Port Authority. You might be selling pencils, you might be doing landscaping, you might be doing painting, you might be doing sheetrocking and all those things. So we ask them to go to PA Procure and at least register your business. And what that does is, take for example, right now we're doing a major rebuild, build at Newark Airport. And the project has been going on for a year, is going to go on for probably two more years, but it'll be a brand new terminal at Newark Airport, you know, at a cost of about $1.4 billion. There are tons of opportunities and jobs and goods and services that are going to be part of that. And so in order to, whether it's the person who's blessed enough to provide coffee to all those construction workers every day for a year, whether it's the local gas stations where all the fuel trucks come in and fill up, or it's the person who's able to provide other sources, whether it's the sheetrock or whether it's steel, whatever those services would be, there are tons of them. And we want folks to at least be certified by the Port Authority. So the design build or the firm that has won the contract will be able to get their 30% credit because they're using certified firms. So the first thing is we want firms to get certified. You're going to be certified as a minority business enterprise. You can be certified as a small business enterprise, a woman business enterprise. This is disadvantaged business enterprise. There are a number of certifications. The latest one that we just announced, I want to say last November, was a service disabled veteran owned business. And so we want to be as inclusive as possible, but we want to make sure that these firms are certified. And then once they see you on our certified list and they hire you, they will then in turn get credit from us.
Okay. A quick question that is, how would you consider the certification process in terms of complexity or difficulty, you know, for someone new to this process?
So, great question. Coming into the job, returning to the Port Authority and going through the certification process, we are constantly trying to make it less complex, right? And what I say by that is, it requires an individual to fill out a number of a set of paperwork. The good news is, a set of questions. The good news is it's online now, right? And so, so I'm hesitating a little bit because there are some people say it is just absolutely too complex. And there are other people who say man, that was really, really good, really easy, not a problem. So we've done things to show you the gamut. We've done things where we've come to the city of Newark. We pre-announced that we were coming in, and we said we want to certify you in one day, but just make sure you bring these documents. You could bring them on a jump drive, you can have them in the cloud somewhere and download them once you get there. But if you bring these documents, we will get you on your way to being certified in a day. There are also horror stories where it's taken some people a couple of months to get certified. But when we dig into that, it's typically something as, well, you have to not only show that you are the owner of the business, that you have the correct paperwork on that business, but you have to also show how did you get the funds to start that business. And so, you know, given the environment we're in now with Homeland Security and money laundering and all that, you can't just show up, put down a chunk of money and say, I want to start a new business, please certify me. Not that people would do that, but we have to have these rules and regulations to make sure that we can always trace back to you are who you say you are. And so in some of these cases, a husband and a wife started a business together. The wife funded the business because she was working all day. The husband was, you know, the architect behind the business process and all that. They fall out. The wife wants to come through and continue to be certified, or the husband wants to come through and be certified. And so you got to work through all of that, like who actually owns the business, who sourced the business. So that could end up in a very complex horror story. But on balance, I would say the process is very straightforward, is very clear. And we have a certification manager and a team. We handhold people through the process until they can get certified, because certification is just the first step along the line of getting contracts and getting business. So we want people to get certified, and then we want them to be certified, and then we want them to maintain their profile adequately once they are certified. So you could start out today, and let's say you come in as a interior design or a architect, and maybe you have, you know, two or three jobs under your belt today. But then 5 years from now, your business has grown and you got two or three more staff members, you got six more major jobs under your belt, or 16 more major jobs. If you're not keeping your profile up to date in terms of your business capacity, then when we go into the database to look and match somebody to a current opening, we won't look at you as sort of a, you know, mid-tier firm. We would still look at you as a startup firm because you haven't updated your profile. So there's a lot of back and forth between the individual entrepreneur and the agency to make sure we know who you are, what you're doing, where you're doing it, how you're doing it. And that helps us help you.
And I wanted to circle back for a second. Something when you started out, you mentioned how in terms of building the capacity, you provided all of this kind of education and training for these individual, you know, architects that they probably didn't have in-house.
Right.
When you provided that and you got a good response, did Port Authority pick up that cost? Was that free to these individuals, or was this sharing of cost? Was there anything that these small business owners had to pay?
For this particular one, it would be their car fare to get there and parking. But okay. The Port Authority picked up those. And that's a good question, because we, and I will email you, we have an event coming up, I want to say September 10th, that focuses on building your back office. And so let's say you're a small construction firm, and you have a staff of two or three people, and you want one or two of those folks to be responsible for sourcing new business, doing RFPs, but you don't have the wherewithal to train them, right? And so we're offering a construction admin 101 3-day course. It's going to be virtual. And that's going to be actually September 22nd. That starts. September 10th is a session that we're doing in conjunction with New Jersey Transit and Essex County to talk about what's available between our different agencies. So that might be something your audience wants to tune into. But as a rule, we're always doing outreach and training. And for the most part, the Port Authority is underwriting those expenses. Now, we do have an arrangement with the organization called the Regional Alliance, and they do OSHA training on our behalf, which is the occupational safety and hazard training that the construction folks need. And they also do 8-week, pre-COVID, 8-week training on construction management, where you get 24 continuing education units when you go through this program. And the Regional Alliance, we provide them with some funding, but they also have sort of like a small dollar amount for that program. I think it's $100 for the 8 weeks.
Wow.
So we try to make sure that cost is not a barrier. And then the other thing I would say, when you become certified, you put you on a mailing list. So every time we're doing some type of outreach or training, like we had a training on what are the successful things you need to do as a construction manager, for argument's sake, or a one day doing business with the Port Authority. When we put on these different things, you're on a mailing list. And you get invited to them, and your time permits, you can come and get that training. So outreach is a big part of what we do in the organization, but specifically in the D&I, Diversity and Inclusion Department.
And again, as this flows, I'm coming with other questions that weren't planned. Mm-hmm. That mailing list. How do we get on that mailing list? Do you have to be certified to get on a mailing list? Are they tied together? Are they separate? What I'm looking at is, could I get on that mailing list to then share with people in my circle as a way of, again, outreach?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. Yes, certified, you definitely get on that. But we also have what we call stakeholder communities, or as I use the term, thinking partners. And so, the fact that you have a group of people who are interested in entrepreneurship, we will want to know your website and your mailing address. So every time we have something, we could just send it to you and say, you know, please share this with your network. And so, yes, we can definitely put you on there to make sure that your group is knowledgeable about what's up and coming. And they can self-select whether they want to participate. I also would encourage your folks to really, you know, dive into our website. It's a lot of information, as most websites go. But when you think of an organization our size and, you know, 600 projects that we might be working on as part of our capital program, there's a lot of information out there. So I warn you, be patient with us. The information is there, but you got to spend some time navigating the website. But I definitely encourage you to do that. And that's panynj.gov. But I'll also give you a specific website for supply and diversity, because I think that's probably where most of your folks want to go to, where they can start the certification process, as well as learn about all of our different programs for outreach. And so that one is also it's panynj.diversitysoftware.com.
That diversity software?
Yeah, that diversity software, one word, .com. And again, that's for those who are interested in starting the certification process.
Okay.
PANYNJ.gov is our main website.
Yeah. And again, going back to something that you said earlier, you used the example where you give out a large contract to a construction company, and then they have to share 30% of that with minority women-owned small businesses. And that could be sharing in any capacity. They don't have to be necessarily construction firms. Again, using sort of the example that you mentioned, if they wanted a dedicated food truck to be there every day, they could hire a minority food truck vendor, and that would count toward the 30%.
That's correct. But I will say, if they're going to hire someone under the name of construction help, mm-hmm. they have to be doing a commercial useful function. So they can't hire you as a construction aide to go buy 3,000 cups of coffee. Yeah. Try to get the percentage. We won't allow that.
Okay.
And let's say you're supplying, right? Let's say you don't actually do the I use sheetrock as an example. You don't do the installation, but maybe you have a supply house where you could sell it to them. Well, they can buy it from you as a minority vendor and get credit for buying whatever that amount is. We have a formula for them to get a certain percentage of the credit for supply.
Okay.
So a supplier will not generate the same credit as a contractor or a worker.
Oh, got it. Okay.
They will get credit for that. But when they're saying you're going to be working on a project alongside of them, you really have to have a piece of the work. Whether you're building one or two rooms over here and somebody else is building one or two rooms over there, again, you just can't be, you know, a typical a gopher or, you know, just standing around looking nice. It has real work. And we call that a commercial useful function.
Okay. based on what you've your time at Port Authority and working with, again, minority woman-owned businesses, do you see any, let me actually rephrase that. What do you see as the benefit, you know, outside of the direct that I'm doing work for, say, Port Authority? Would you say it's just a good business resume function? It's some of the things that you share with me in terms of the free training, I see that as a benefit, but what would you convince somebody to say why you should be on the certification list if you had to try to pitch it?
First of all, and again, this is pre-COVID. All of us recognize that things, we're in a different space right now with things slowing down, and prayerfully they'll get back to a sense of normalcy. I don't necessarily agree with people saying it's going to be a new normal, because I don't think the old was normal, but that's another story.
I like that.
For argument's sake, I say that, you know, an agency our size, if you are certified, and let me say it this way. So I got a call this morning that one of the firms that I'm working with just won a prime contract that's probably going to last all of 2 years. And they're going to be doing a number of different things around a Port Authority facility. They would not have won that prime contract if they had, one, not been certified. Two, they had not demonstrated quality work over a number of years. And three, that they had, you know, support of many folks like myself, constantly pushing them to, you know, compete for opportunities as they come up at the agency. So this person is going to have work that's going to keep her firm busy for at least the next 2 years. Major, major benefit. The single major benefit I would say is long after that we're gone, I'm gone, people on the call are gone, there's going to be some agency called the Port Authority. Somebody may come in and try to change the name, but it's going to be an entity that's going to keep rebuilding roads, rebuilding bridges, refurbishing airports and the like, which means that there's always going to be business opportunities coming from that entity. And you as a certified business doing work with that entity can always rest assured knowing that something else is coming down the pike. The other thing is, as we said before, you get to interact and get to know other folks in your space that you may decide, well, you know, we did some work here, but maybe we can go over to New Jersey Transit and replicate what we did for the Port Authority, or maybe we go to the Department of Transportation, or maybe we decide we want to go to another part of the country because now they are following in the footsteps of what this agency just did. And so I think there are a number of benefits just to being certified. And again, when you go into that database, that software, diversity software, that is the engine for that is something called B2G, business to government. And once you're in that database, you can find people all over the country that you might want to work with or might want to work alongside with or maybe even hire to come help you do a project that you have that might be a stretch for your current company.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of just shift a little bit to, again, you mentioned, you know, operating during the COVID and how things have changed. You know, when you think about how your organization has changed, is there anything that jumps out at like major changes that you guys have done that you could translate to small business owners? Hey, here's something that we've done. This might be something that you might want to consider.
The first thing I would say is communicate. We've stepped up our communication with our stakeholders, with our minority women-owned businesses, to the extent that we, early on back in March, whatever resources that were available either from us or from anyone around us, we put that together in a document and we send that out to people on our mailing list, people part of our database, and saying, look, so-and-so is offering this program over here. So-and-so has this idea over here. It's just a whole list of business resources. And you can get on that you send the email, I can put you on that as well. But that was one of the first things that we did, say, okay, let's talk about how we can help each other during this process. So communicate. I would also say that in any business, in all businesses, and in all cases of leadership, you know, I think it was Warren Bennis said, our first job is to define the reality. And so as things were changing, we wanted to make sure we defined the reality. So if we had to make changes internal to, let's say, our scope of projects that we had on the drawing board to roll out over the next couple of years, if we decided that we had to retrench any of those things, the first thing that we said from our organization to the larger organization is we want to make sure there's no disparate impact on a minority and women-owned businesses. So if there's any talk about cutting across the board, whatever position they are in today, relative to the remaining organizations, we want them to be in that same position tomorrow. So make sure that there's no disparate impact. And then again, from my standpoint, encouraging folks to say there are things that maybe you couldn't get done individually, make sure you're looking to collaborate even more to make sure that everybody has a chance at winning an opportunity.
So what I heard there was, again, communicate and collaborate.
Communicate, collaborate. And I will also say there's got to be a level of agility and flexibility. We weren't sending out that form before COVID. We weren't saying, here's a list of resources we think will be helpful to you. But once we recognized that people were either held up in their offices or in their homes, and they weren't necessarily connected to where they would come into our offices, or there wasn't a lot of in-person gathering and networking and, you know, coming to this meeting or that meeting, we said, well, let's get information out to them. And so it was just, you know, being flexible, being agile, and just doing something different to meet the moment.
Okay. Now, what's the name of that list you said you could put?
We call it a COVID-19 resource list.
Okay. Have you noticed since COVID a shift in the purchasing, you know, whether it's product, services, again, projects that are an exact result of the pandemic? So did you guys start buying more, again, Lysol? Like, can you think of certain things that definitely saw an increase or new?
Yeah, so I'm aware of that. I can't speak to it specifically, but I can tell you that our purchasing department sent out like an all points bulletin early on about anybody who's doing anything with the PPE. They wanted to know them, and they wanted to see, you know, what prices and what volume they can get from those different companies. So even though I didn't physically see that, I know us, like other agencies, we, you know, you think about the bus terminal and the hundreds of thousands of people go through there, through World Trade Center. We had a ridership of path of 200,000 a day drop down to under 10,000. But we still had to make sure that we could social distance and clean the trains, clean the bus terminals, make sure that there were signs to direct people certain places, because some of the bathrooms might have been closed down, in order to we could you know, accommodate social distancing and still monitor free flow of customers and traffic. So I would say, without a doubt, you know, our purchasing patterns, like other organization purchases patterns, would change as a result of COVID. I just can't speak directly to the amount and the type of change.
Okay. In your, say, conversations, interacting with, again, businesses of various sizes, are you aware, on a larger scale, on a more macro level, possible opportunities that may be coming up? They don't even have to be with directly with, you know, your agency, but just in your conversations or your reading, in terms of, you know, if you wanted to tell somebody, hey, you know what, you might want to consider this industry or this product or service that's emerging.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, the short answer is I can't think of where I would direct, you know, let's say my granddaughter, Blair, like, you need to start putting some focus on this area or that area or the other, because these are the new jobs that are coming out. But what I can say is, I really want you to, we had this conversation, I really want you to be an absolute great communicator in all possible ways, from your written reports to your public speaking, what have you. I want you to invest time in becoming an exceptional communicator. And I also want you to do what, you know, a lot of the public stopped doing after they left school is I want you to become a very robust reader. Because I told her leaders are readers. And while people might be saying a lot of stuff, they don't have any substance to really back it up. But if you spend time reading and making up your own ideas about what you read so that you can have a conversation about that, that's going to put you way ahead of the pack. And the other thing I say to her is, and I'm very honest with her, I say, you know, I am where I am today as a result of every decision I made in my life. So think about the decisions, because the future doesn't just happen. It's created by our decisions. And so I really want you to think about your decisions, the quality of your decision, you know what you believe and why you believe it. And then I want you to make sure that you are not putting any limiting beliefs on yourself. So understand what you believe, why you believe it, but I absolutely want you to think about communication. So and how do we talk about that? We read different books together, right? And then we talk about those books. What did you get from this? What are you getting from that? And so whether it's, you know, George Orwell, 1984, which you read last summer, or is James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time, which we read this summer. You know, I'm encouraging her to read, and then let's talk about it. And no answer is a wrong or a right answer. It's just how you're processing information. And the way you process information is going to be the gateway to decisions that you make. And I like to share with her, as I do with others, you know, I think Steve Covey had it right. You know, he said life is lived in right in that sweet spot between stimulus and response, because that's where we make our choices. We get stimulated by something, we respond. But if we don't make that decision or that right choice in the middle, you know, two people having the same stimulus could have a completely different life based on their response if they don't take that time to think about what's motivating me here and why am I about to do what I'm about to do. It's in that sweet spot, that small space between stimulus and response, where choices, the quality of life is determined.
That what you just said makes me think of another book that's on my list, which I believe the title is Think Fast, Think Slow, or Think Slow, Think Fast, where the author talks about that thing, that the way our brain works. We have something where there's immediate response, and then we have the process of thinking something out, and we need to understand the two so that we make the proper decisions.
Exactly.
Because they both serve a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
To my understanding, Keith, you are a certified coach. All right, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, John Maxwell certified coach.
That's correct.
Nice.
Yes, yeah. I wanted to act like I didn't know that. All right. if I could tap into that side of your intellect, what would you advise, or how would you, guide, say, small business owners during this time of chaos? Again, from a coach's perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so when you think about coaching, and I learned this in while I was still at Fannie Mae, and I was putting together a new group to do software installation. And I came across this data point that so you can tell people something and they might remember 10%. Or people can read something and they might remember 20% of it. But when you coach them through something, they remember 70% or higher. And so that stuck with me, that what you're saying, when you're coaching, you're bringing them along. And then I thought about being a high school cross country runner and playing basketball. And I thought about my greatest mentor, a gentleman by the name of Jesse Miles, who coached so many young men and women in our community. And I tried to think about, well, what is the real essence of coaching? And that essence of coaching is really pulling out of the individual what they either refuse to recognize or maybe they don't recognize, but you got to pull it out in such a way that it increases their confidence to do what they were put here to do, right? And so there's a gift in us. There's something in us. There's a skill in us that we may not immediately tap into. But as a coach, the coach is there to help pull that out. And so putting on my coaching hat, talking to small businesses now, I would just continually say to them, it really is important for you to make sure that you are not just asking the right question. In other words, in history, they teach us that if you properly frame the question, you're halfway to the answer. But not just making sure that you're asking the right question, but make sure you're thinking through the questions and the answers and you understand your why. You'll hear people talk about this now, it's kind of faddish, but it's always been why. You want to open up a business, and you may not recall this conversation. We had a conversation years ago when I was applauding you because you know you just love being an entrepreneur. And you know, if you're not creating something, if you're not being an entrepreneur, it dulls your senses. And I said to you, you know, I'm excited about that. But my passion is being inside corporate America, helping entrepreneurs. And I'm okay with that. Now, you know, you'll get the $25 million contract being an entrepreneur, but I'll be the manager inside who is the advocate for you, opening the ways to make that happen. But that I'm okay with that because that's my why, right? I understand that. And when you understand yours, then you understand what's motivating you and your company and the reason why you're doing these things. So if there's one thing I would say from a coaching standpoint, if you're doing something today, and you don't know why you're doing it, you need to stop. That would be the first thing, right? You just need to stop. Go somewhere and sit down and think about why you're doing what it is that you're doing or why you want to do something else. And there's a book I share I don't know if I shared it with you, but I just shared it with my children about 3 or 4 years ago called The One Thing.
Oh, I actually think I have that.
Yep. Yeah. And so the one thing really talks about if you did one thing that could allow you to live the life that you absolutely deserve and want just by doing this one thing, what would that be? And so, you know, you look at, and so it's easy to look at athletes and say, wow, they can do air, they can travel, they can have big houses, they can do all this, and all they're doing is playing basketball, football, baseball, what have you. But you think about the life of a Kobe Bryant, who spent enormous hours perfecting his craft because he wanted to be the best of all times. And those times spent perfecting his craft then allowed him and his family to live the life that they wanted to live. What's that one thing that you would do? Is it speaking? Is it writing? Is it dancing? Is it teaching? You know, all of us have at least one example of a teacher who just made us think we could fly, right? And it might have been in the fifth grade, it might have been in high school, it might have been in college, but all of us had that. Think about how that teacher got up every day to come to work. What did they do, right? And you know, and put it another way, people say, I see you got Dr. King album up there behind you. What did Dr. King's fifth grade teacher say to him to make him think he could make it work? Right? And so again, going back to your dedication and, you know, we're standing on the shoulders, we really have to think about that, you know, both in our small circles, but in a larger circle. So we don't fall off into idolatry, idolizing everybody who's doing something that we can't seem to be doing, but we reflect on the fact that they're doing something that's placed in them, that someone motivated to bring it out, and now they're doing their absolute best. What's that one thing for you? Is what I would say to these business. And maybe it's not doing the business, maybe it's managing the business. Maybe it's doing something completely different, or maybe it's doing this on a greater scale. But what is it?
It's interesting that you tapped on, again, that one thing for you was being inside the corporation, again, helping entrepreneurs. Because ironically, that's been one of my pet peeves that I would say to people in my age. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're inside, you know what? Why aren't you sharing? You know what? You don't even have to say, well, I'm going to get you a contract. Mm-hmm. But at least share the information,
right,
to folks out here as to what's going on. And then even being that, again, resource to help folks to say, listen, you know what? I can't put you on a list until you do X, Y, and Z.
Exactly.
You know, in other words, as a coach or a friend, say, yeah, I'm going to tell you what you need to do to get, you know, part of this pie. Mm-hmm. But we have this kind of a divide between, you know, in the house, out in the field type mentality. And sure. I really think to build a community, there needs to be a bridge.
Right.
You know, so I wish more people were here because, you know, some of the things that you mentioned, which I'm going to follow up with you to try to get that out to the, you know, larger community. Again, we're not going to make promises. This is not about handouts, but first, you know, you need to know, as I would always say to my students, the first thing I ask them at the beginning of every class is, are you familiar with the term epistemic risk? Which mm-hmm. most students would say, no. I said, the risk of not knowing what you do not know. Now, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what Port Authority's offering. Well, right. There's a risk. Well, right. Now you know.
But now you know.
Now you know. Now, and I say, once you know, it allows you to start asking questions.
Exactly.
And that's where the conversation begins because, oh, now I go out to the website. I see it. I now can come back and say, oh, well, what does this mean? Or how do I do this? And the dialogue begins.
Right, exactly. So,
I really appreciate that. And the other thing too, when you said about helping the entrepreneurs out here, I've been trying to get my brother to give me $5 because I haven't got the $25 million contract yet. somehow that doesn't fall under helping out entrepreneurs out here, but that's okay.
Well, you know, and then there's another part of where you have to think differently. You have to reflect how much value I gave you in this last hour. And think about how much it would cost you to go someplace else and pay for that. And just think about that as the blessing.
Oh, you see how you twisted that, right, Shelley? Huh? But I'll take it.
Good. Right.
Point taken.
Good. Or point I taken. Mean, or I can send you an invoice.
No, that's okay. Keep your $5.
You know, whichever you prefer.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Then you took it. From the work to the coaching to the history, I can send you 3 invoices.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
I'll send you $5, all right? Shelley, and let me see, we have a caller on, And I'm wondering if it's, well, yeah. Who's the caller who signed in? Hello? Yeah, I'm not sure who
that is. Great, I thought I was on mute. Hello, okay. Everyone.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello.
Yeah. You want to introduce yourself? You know who she is, Keith, but I'm going to let her introduce herself.
Hi, Brother Keith.
Hello? Who's that?
Hello?
Is it Deb?
It's Deb.
Oh, hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing
good.
Well.
Good.
Yeah, before we close out, any questions for Keith from Shelly?
I just had one about the certification. You were talking about after you, some entity that would be like the Port of Authority will still need to have trades and things to happen. That certification that you go through, that process, is it updated every year, or once you're certified, you're always certified?
Great, a great question. So they have different maturity dates. Okay. And so, and that will be explained when you go to the website, but some, like, so for the disadvantage, I believe that it has to be renewed every 3 years.
Okay.
The MBE may have to be renewed every 5 years. Don't quote me on this. I'm not the expert, but there are certification cycles. And what happens is basically the agency will send you as you enter into your what's called your recertification year. The agency will send you an email and say, okay, we want to make sure that nothing material has changed, and you have to, you know, validate that you are still 51% owner and you still that sort of thing. But okay. There is a process for you to be recertified, and like I say, you will be reminded in ample time when that date is approaching.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Deb, oh, she disappeared. Again, and going back to one thing before we close out is you mentioned, you know, the thing about, you know, leaders are readers. And I believe that if you look at all successful people, most of them are, you know, avid, like readers, like big readers. But I've always found it challenging to try to, like, you know, to follow in that. I tried to inspire people to form book clubs, because mm-hmm. just reading and then discussing the topic.
Right.
I always found it challenging that, you know, somehow, as much as it's needed, especially for entrepreneurs, that people still seem to be a little hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
And but with that being said, you know, what would be your recommended books to read from your most recent book list?
So there is a bless you. There is
thank you.
I think I might have posted on internet or something. So I just read Eddie's he's a professor at Princeton, Eddie Gorton. I just read his book, Begin Again.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and what was interesting, I definitely recommend that. And the reason why I recommend that is because he's actually introducing or reintroducing James Baldwin
mm-hmm.
to the reading community, or to the thinking community, or to the activist community. And one of the things that's striking about his book, and is so timely, and we're shifting gears now, so we're done with Port Authority stuff, so turn over to community stuff. But one of the things that's so interesting in there is how he identifies and relates almost page by page or play by play how the current incumbent is working or is actually working off of Ronald Reagan's playbook.
Wow.
He gives example after example. The law and order, even though it's associated mostly with Nixon, is Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place where Cheney, Goodwin, and Goodman and Sherman, their bodies were found, and announcing his reelection campaign. His dog whistles to certain communities and telling about welfare queens and all that. It's just very interesting how he talks about these parallels and how they're replaying this over and over again. So I found that fascinating that, you know, he's saying that James Baldwin spoke truth to power in 1963 in the midst of the South. He was friends with Dr. King and he was friends with Malcolm X, and he was kind of a bridge between the different communities. Although, you know, some of the younger folks, Stokely Carmichael and them, had ugly things to say at times, but James Baldwin was a powerful thinker. And it shows you how some of that is missing in today's mix, or I shouldn't say missing, but is more dispersed as opposed to being concentrated in the community of folks you had there. So that was a very, very interesting read. And the underlying premise in that book is we have these problems because there are too many people who believe, support, and carry out each day the belief that white people matter more than anybody else. That's the fundamental premise. Whites matter more. So you can get shot in the back seven times and you could be shackled to your hospital bed, even though you can't walk. Or you could kill two people and get taken to Burger King or some other place. And it's just a matter of, well, what color is their skin? So he kind of really brings that out. And then subsequent to that, I read this book called White Fragility.
Mm-hmm.
And this lady, Robin DiAngelo, she basically says, the reason why it's so hard for white people to talk about race is because they don't want to confess the privilege that they have from mm-hmm. being white and being in America.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes through example by example by example, but it correlates directly to Eddie's book on white people matter more. And in their worldview, that's exactly. So when 45 says, make America great again, that's code word for, I want all of y'all who have this skin darker than mine to leave. And we just want, which has never been the case in America, but that's what they're trying to say. If we can just have white rule, we can be happy again. And so in her book, she talks about, she gives a really good example of how we rally around to protect white people's feelings because we don't want to hurt their feelings, right? And so you could look at a mom whose son just got shot seven times, but she has the grace and the presence to say, I want everybody to come together. And she gives an example of doing an exercise where she called out one of her students because she failed to acknowledge an African-American woman in the class as she was talking. In other words, she kind of talked right past her. So the teacher used that as a teaching moment, say, here's an example of what African-Americans and people of color go through every day, all day. This woman just stated such XYZ. You dismiss that. When someone else said the very same thing, you acknowledge that. So when a teacher brought that example out, the white woman started crying. And so when she started crying, then the rest of the class was like, oh my God, you made her cry, this, that, and the other. She got up, she left the class, the rest of the class. And she showed that as an example that we can't even tell the truth mm-hmm. about what really happened because your feelings would get hurt. You're going to leave the class, and then other white people in the class are going to come to your desk and rally around them. She shouldn't have talked to you like that. She took, and the whole idea is like, how do we break through this impasse that we have if we're never going to acknowledge that we are all human and we all have the same right to feelings, emotion, and so on and so forth. So it's called White Fragility. She has lots of documentation in there. And then the last book that I read in the last month or so is William Barber's The Third Reconstruction. And that's a powerful book because it deals with sort of, again, it's Black advance, white backlash. Black advance, white backlash. And so he uses the Civil War as sort of the first reconstruction, what happened after the Civil War. And then he points towards the 60s and Dr. King as sort of second reconstruction. And now he's saying, and I absolutely believe he's right, that we're in the midst of the third reconstruction. And if we don't find a way to collaborate with like-minded people across all hues that want to do the right thing for humanity's sake, then all of us are going to go to hell in a handbasket.
Uh-huh.
He says, we got people everywhere. He said, and I love his quote, he says, there's nothing worse than someone being loud and wrong.
And
we know about that. We know about that in our community. But he says, if we don't collaborate and come together collectively, all of us are going to, you know, is back to Dr. King saying, either, you know, we will all live together or we'll all perish as fools. You know, so we live together as one humanity or we'll all perish as fools. So it really is our choice. So, you know, and there, you know, a number of books that, you know, I have on my reading list on my desk that I'm, you know, intending to get to. But is it, you know, I think those three would be helpful to your audience and your listeners, particularly in this time that we're living right now of protests and monumental change. Whatever happens, I don't see us going backwards to what someone called normal. It will be a different environment for us, and certainly different for our children and our children's children.
Well, I appreciate that, Keith. I appreciate the recommended reading. I think we've taken up, enough of your time. Mm-hmm. Conversation has gone much longer. It was good, but much longer than normal. So again, very much appreciate it. I will follow up with you to get the information, which I will share to the audience.
Okay.
Okay. As always, appreciate having you in my life.
Okay. Good talking to you. Shelly, good seeing you again.
You as well. Thank you so much.
And Sister Deb, nice seeing your caller ID.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.